Well, we've had two introductory sessions. We have looked at the portrait of Christ, the Christ-centered life, and just generally as we looked over these virtues and saw why we think these are a portrait of Christ-likeness here. And then in our last session, session two, we looked at the provisions for the Christ-centered life. And now we actually want to begin looking at these essential virtues one by one. And so these first two sessions were introductory. We now actually enter part one. And in part one, we're going to look at the groundwork of Christian character. And if you'll refer to your chart again, you'll see that we're to add to our saving faith this pursuit of the excellence of Jesus Christ. And then we're to add to that knowledge. And so in this part, we want to look at the groundwork of Christian character. Peter tells us to add to our faith virtue. The King James translates the first word in the list as virtue. And that can be a bit confusing for us because actually all of these qualities are virtues. And we want to explore what does that particular word mean. The actual word that's translated virtue here is arete. The classical philosophers, Socrates and Plato and Aristotle, spoke more about arete than any other virtue. And it's quite surprising then when we come into the New Testament and we find that this word is only used five times in all of the New Testament when the classical philosophers spoke about this more than any other thing. And three of those times of the five uses in the New Testament are right here in 2 Peter 1. In verse 3, he says that God has called us to glory and virtue. That's arete. And in the Bible, we have to use the Bible to tell us what these words mean. They will always retain some of the flavor of their secular use, but in the Bible, they'll always take on some kind of a little bit of flavor as they're baptized into the Christian usage. And so it's very important to understand the context to understand the meaning of the words in the Bible. The problem here is that it's only used five times. So it's a little hard to garner from those five times exactly what it means, but we still can do that. But the first three are mentioned in this chapter, as I mentioned, and it starts out that he's called us to glory in virtue. And that doesn't help us a lot to understand what it means. The word always has something to do with excellence. So we know that God is calling us to His glory and some sort of excellence. And then the second time it's used here is when he says we're to add to our faith virtue. And then the next verse says, and to virtue knowledge. So we have three of the five uses right here, and they haven't really given us a lot of hints about what it is like. Paul gives us another little flavor. Paul uses the word only one time in Philippians 4:8. When he says, whatsoever things are true, honest, just, pure, lovely, of good report, if there's any virtue, if there's any excellence in this, if there's any praise, then think on these things. The final use of it is in 1 Peter 2:9, and we're going to get to that in a minute, because I think that really tells us what this word means. But let's go back to the way the classical philosophers talked about this verse, about this word. Aristotle, I think, got it right when he said that what makes you excellent, what makes you have arete, is tied to your telos, or to your end, or to your purpose. And Aristotle would say something like this, you cannot call that sword at your side an excellent sword, an arete sword, unless it cuts things. If it has a shiny blade and a beautifully crafted handle, but it doesn't cut anything, it's not an excellent sword. It doesn't do what swords are designed to do. So it's not excellent. It doesn't have arete. It doesn't have excellence. Or it'd say that boat out in the harbor that you used to fish with, that is not an excellent boat if it won't float. It can have a beautifully straight mast and have beautifully crafted sails and a wonderful paint job on it. But if it doesn't float, it doesn't do what boats are supposed to do. It's not fulfilling its purpose, its telos, and therefore it does not possess arete. It is not excellent. You couldn't consider yourself an excellent soldier, according to Aristotle, if you ran every time there was a battle. You might be able to say, well, I've collected knickknacks from all kinds of countries in the world. It doesn't matter how many countries you've been in. If every time you're in a battle you run from it, you're not an excellent soldier. You don't have arete. because the essential purpose of a soldier is to fight. Well, then the question comes to us, what does it mean for a human to be excellent? And by the way, the classical philosophers bantered that one around a lot. What is virtue? What makes a man excellent? What makes a polis, a whole group of people, a city, what makes it excellent? And I believe Peter tells us in 1 Peter 2:9 what it means to have excellence as a believer. In 1 Peter 2:9 he says, "But ye are a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, and holy nation, a people of his own." That, and here is the purpose statement. The telos, this is a purpose statement, that, henna in the Greek, that ye should show forth the excellencies or the praises, the arete, of the one that has called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. So what is Peter doing here? He's saying God has arete, God has excellence. God is very good at being God. In fact, in everything that constitutes being God, he gets an A++ in everything that gods do and gods are supposed to be. He's an excellent God. He entirely fulfills his purpose and his end. And what is our purpose? To show forth the character, the excellencies of that God. That's what makes us excellent. And we can have beautiful clothes, we can be talented, we can have wonderful this or that, but if we are not displaying the character of God, we are not fulfilling our purpose. We are not excellent. We don't have arete. Peter says our purpose is that we should show forth the arete, the excellencies of the one who's called us out of darkness into his marvelous light. And Peter is going to describe for us in this passage exactly what that excellent Christian looks like. He looks like somebody whose purpose to develop this arete, this excellence of Christ. He looks like somebody who is developing who is gaining the knowledge of what it means to be like Christ. He's gaining self-control and endurance and godliness and brotherly kindness and love. And a person who is displaying these essential virtues is excellent. He has arete. He's what a Christian ought to be. I would like to propose a working definition of this word arete or virtue in the King James. We must be cultivating a God-mandated purpose to develop and display the excellencies, the character of Jesus Christ. In short, we're to be pursuing the excellence of Christ-likeness. Now, folks, we have to come to the realization at some point in our Christian walk that we are on this planet for one reason alone, and that is to show forth the excellencies of Jesus Christ by displaying those things in our life. That's why we're here. That's the only reason. And if we're doing something else with our life, we may be good at this or that, but we're certainly not excellent Christians. We don't have arete. Paul understood this when he told us in Romans 12, 1 and 2. He said, "I appeal to you, therefore, brothers, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God, which is your spiritual worship. Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewal of your mind, that by testing you may discern what is the will of God, what is good and acceptable and perfect." Paul understood that we're here for one purpose, and that is to be conformed to the image of Jesus Christ, to display the excellencies of Jesus Christ in our lives. We might ask the question, why does he say present your bodies a living sacrifice? Well, when he's talking about our bodies there, he's talking about the totality of our life in this context. It would be very similar if you have a mother to what would be happening if a mother is trying to get her preschool son to come in from the sandbox out in the backyard. And she's called him a couple of times and says, "Johnny, come on in, it's time for supper," and he doesn't come. Finally, she might say, "Johnny, get your little body in here." Now, she's not just wanting a corpse to come through the door. She's wanting everything, his spirit too. She wants every part of this little boy coming. Well, that's exactly the way Paul is using this. He says, I want you to present your body, everything that you have, as a living sacrifice. And the opposite of that is to be conformed to this world. Most of us who have come at one time or another to that kind of commitment that my life belongs to God. And by the way, it's kind of like marriage. You do that, you start that at an altar, and I don't necessarily mean you have to come to an altar here. You can bow before God in your car or somewhere else. But you come to God and say, God, I am yours. I have never really set this before you before, but I am yours. But then you renew that a whole lot of times. I mean, you got to come to that realization again and again. It's just like getting married. One event starts all of that, but there are a lot of times when you keep reminding yourself, you know, I promise to do this, and I must, and I will, and I promise to love her, and I will. And you renew that kind of commitment again and again and again and again. And you do the same with God in cultivating that virtue, that purpose to become like Jesus Christ. Most of us who did that, who are really cultivating this in our lives, came to that position the first time when we saw somebody else, another believer, who really was dedicated to God. And we said, I want to be like that guy. It may have been one of our parents. It may have been our youth pastor. It may have been a counselor at camp. But we saw that kind of commitment in somebody's life and we said, boy, that's what I want. I remember as a young teenager reading Jungle Pilot about Jim Elliot and starting to look at some things about that man's life. And I remember that one saying of his, he is no fool who gives up that which he cannot keep to save that which he cannot lose. That's amazing. You know what that is? That's a statement of dedication. That's a call to arete. That's what Peter is calling us to in this. This is a call to discipleship. Folks, this is a call to normal Christianity. What we see in the church generally today is subpar. It's subnormal. There's a lot of worldliness in the church. And I want us to think for a minute about how Christ himself views that kind of abnormal, subnormal Christianity. He addressed a church like that in Revelation chapter 3, the church of Laodicea. In Revelation 3, 15 to 19, he said, I know your works. You are neither cold nor hot. Would that you were either cold or hot. So because you are lukewarm and neither hot nor cold, I will spit you out of my mouth. For you say, I am rich. I have prospered and I need nothing. Not realizing that you are wretched, pitiable, poor, blind, and naked. I counsel you to buy from me gold refined by fire so that you may be rich, and white garments so that you may clothe yourself, and the shame of your nakedness may not be seen, and salve to anoint your eyes so that you may see. Those whom I love, I reprove and discipline, so be zealous and repent. God is calling a lukewarm church, and that may be many, many of us. He's calling us to zeal, to zealousness, to wholehearted single-mindedness, and repent of our self-centeredness. Christ is rebuking this church because they are subpar, they are below standard, they are deficient. This call to discipleship, to cultivating this God-mandated purpose to develop and display the excellencies of the character of Christ, is normal for the Christ-centered life. And by the way, this is that large head of the embryo. This is the brain that is going to drive and determine and control the development, all of the rest of the body. If this commitment to become like Jesus Christ is not in place and growing in our lives, the rest of our development is going to be deformed. This is part of the challenge that we have in Christian education. Whether it is Christian education on the collegiate level, or Christian education on a high school or elementary school level, or Christian parenting. In Christian high schools and Christian colleges in particular, we're trying to add knowledge to these young people, the knowledge of God. And we're trying to add self-control and endurance to people who in many cases have not yet decided to be like Christ in the first place. And therefore, all of their development is truncated and deformed because this purpose to become like Jesus Christ is not driving everything they do. They have some knowledge of God, but they learned it for the test. They didn't learn it because they wanted to become like Jesus Christ. They had to learn it because they got to take a test on it. And they've developed some self-control so they don't get demerits or sanctions of some sort, but not because that kind of activity isn't like Jesus Christ. And that's why I say this arete, this purpose to become like Jesus Christ, is first. This is the brain that's going to regulate and control the development of all of the rest of it. And without it, everything else is going to be deformed and it's not going to be a credit to Christ. And we're in a sad state in the church generally today. Why are we in that sad state? Well, it's because the enemy, Lucifer himself, has a not-so-secret weapon. And Paul told us about that weapon in 12:1 and 2 of Romans. He said, "I appeal to you, therefore, brothers, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies as a living sacrifice, holy and acceptable to God, which is your spiritual worship." And then what? Look at the contrast. "Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewal of your mind." Paul puts conformity to the world in direct opposition to spiritual transformation. And Satan has set up this world because he is the prince of the power of the air. He is the one who governs this world. And he has set up this world to entice us away from Christ's likeness to the likeness of his own image. In John 10, verse 10, Jesus promises us abundant life. He said, "I am come that you might have life and that you might have it abundantly." Well, the world has a counterfeit. The world says, "I can give you some things that will make you feel alive and real and fulfilled. They're just temporary fulfillment. It may come through drugs. It may come through illicit sex. It may come through materialism. It may come through some other form of sensuality." But the world is offering us what they would call an abundant life. You can feel real when you do this. You can feel satisfied when you do this. You can feel fulfilled when you do this. But it is a counterfeit. And the church is being seduced away from Christ today by entertainment that is laced with blatant sensuality and violence and materialism, and by addictive adrenaline rushes through drugs and alcohol and extreme sports and gambling and electronic games, and by the lures of power and sex and virtual relationships through pornography and alternative online realities. The world has a lot to offer that says you can feel real and fulfilled and have meaning when you do this. And the believer who spends much time at all in these pursuits is increasingly desensitized to the ways of God and to the likeness of Jesus Christ, and becomes further and further dependent upon these appeals and ideals of the world. Satan is very crafty. He has his own, what I would call, essential vices. We're talking about essential virtues here from Peter, but Satan has some essential vices which form the portrait of one who is increasingly made into his diabolical image. And we can note that progression in Proverbs, through studying the three different kinds of fools in Proverbs. There are three categories of fools, general categories of fools in Proverbs. The first one, I'll tell you all three of them, and we'll talk about them individually here. The first one is the simple man. And that is a person who is weak and worldly. The second one is the fool. I call the simple man your K5 beginner fool. The simple man. whenever you see the word the fool in Proverbs, we're talking about the generic garden variety, common everyday fool. And the scorner is the fool with a graduate degree in foolishness. He's on the other end of it. Well, let's go back and talk about the simple man. The beginning or kindergarten fool who is weak and worldly. By the way, a picture of this is exactly what you would expect to find today in our culture in your average American junior high young person. And I hope the junior hires in this audience are not like this, but this is the average in our world today. And by the way, it's the average of many people who are beyond, it's the average life style of many who are beyond junior high as well. This is the heart. This is a simple one. Remember in Proverbs 5 and Proverbs 7? This is the man who's easily seduced and lured into sin. This junior high mentality, this simple person, the heart is easily captured by the latest fashions. And the pop and reality show idols and superheroes and the electronic games and the sports personalities and the junk foods and the sexual enticements, both real and virtual, and the chemical stimulants, both legal and illegal. And he's very easily seduced by the crude and sensual humor and violence of the latest video clips and latest blockbusters. His life is all about that kind of thing. He's easily bored, and he resists correction. He endures work and school as necessary evils between the pursuits of his pleasure. Spiritually, this kind of person has little tolerance for preaching unless it is very high in entertainment value. This is Proverbs' simple man. Paul talked about that kind of mindset in 2 Timothy 4, 3-4. For the time will come when they will not endure sound doctrine, but wanting to have their ears tickled, they will accumulate for themselves teachers in accordance to their own desires, and will turn away their ears from the truth and will turn aside to myths. Instead of listening to solid truth in preaching, and solid truth coming from mom and dad, they will turn aside to anybody who will tell them what they want to hear. And they will pick the wrong friends, they'll pick the wrong churches. This is Proverbs' simple person. The person who is easily lured. He is weak and he's very willful. And instead of this kind of a young person, instead of spending the formative teen years preparing for adult responsibility, these years are thrown away in the pursuit of pleasure. I think it is interesting that the world is noticing this mindset. I've seen a couple of recent television specials on this whole phenomenon of extended adolescence and what is happening in the workforce as a result of it. I just read a very fascinating book recently by Diana West. She is a syndicated columnist for the Washington Times. The title of the book is The Death of the Grown-Up. Fascinating book. As far as I know, the woman is not a believer. I don't know that. There's certainly nothing that would show that in the book. I want to show you some of the quotes out of the first chapter of this book. She says, once there was a world without teenagers, literally. Teenager, the word itself, doesn't pop into the lexicon much before 1941. This speaks volumes about the last few millennia. In all those centuries, nobody thought to mention teenagers because there was nothing apparently to think of mentioning. Now, she's not down on teenagers, and I'm not down on teenagers. Most of us adults were one at one time. But it's the whole mindset that comes along with it in this day and age that she is decrying, even as a secular person. She goes on and says, and considering what I like to call the death of the grown-up, it is important to keep a fix on this fact, that for all but this most recent episode of human history, there were children and there were adults. There were no teenagers. Children in their teen years aspired to adulthood. Significantly, they didn't aspire to adolescence. Certainly adults didn't aspire to remain teenagers as many of them do today. She said a lot of things have changed. For one thing, turning 13 nowadays, instead of bringing children closer to the adult world, now launches them into a teen universe. For another, due to the permanent hold our culture has placed on the maturation process, that's where they're likely to find most adults. The National Academy of Sciences has, in 2002, redefined adolescence as the period extending from the onset of puberty around 12 to 30. These are grown-ups who haven't left childhood. And if you want to see what that's like, all you have to do is look at almost any ad on television. And you'll find particularly an older, a man who is supposed to be an adult by now. He's probably in his 20s and in his early 30s, who's still acting like a junior higher. He goes with his wife to the big box electronics store. And they've got to get a washer and dryer. I mean, that's an adult thing to do. But he splits off from her as fast as he can, sends her to do that, and he goes looks at the big plasma screens. That's a kid doing that. That's not an adult. An adult goes and gets a washer and dryer because that's what they need. Or he's playing some video game on his computer and they really need to buy a house and they need to look at a house from through a realtor site to where they're supposed to be. It's his wife that has to come in and say, "Honey, we got to get this house nailed down." So he puts aside his game controller and gets on there and they look up a house and they finance and all of that, and then he goes back to his game. The only adult in the picture here are the wives. By the way, folks, that is an intentional thing by our world to destroy manhood and adult responsibility in men and keep them locked into adolescence. It is a beautiful strategy of the enemy, and it's working. That didn't used to happen. A little boy, when he was at play, was playing at adult things. He was taking his truck. It was a miniature truck, but it was what dads do. And she was playing with her dolls or whatever. And I'm not saying that that's all a little girl can do or that's all a little boy can do, but they were playing at miniature adult things. There was no teen universe. That came about in the 50s and the 60s by marketers who saw a great market base here in this group of people. And now we have 50 and 60 year old people still trying to be teenagers, still trying to look like teenagers. That is a sad thing. And Satan is doing a good job of keeping people in this simpleton mode. In fact, you go to an average ball game and you can't tell the difference in behavior between a high schooler and his grandfather with him. They're both out of control. My brethren, these things ought not to be. Even the adults want to act like and stay teenagers. That is horribly tragic. But Satan doesn't leave us there. We move from the simpleton to the fool. Proverbs 14:18 says, "The simple inherit folly." You stay a simple person, weak and worldly, and pretty soon there's a graduation ceremony, put a cap and gown into you, graduate into being a fool. This is the person, when you look up Proverbs all about the fool, this is the person who really bristles at restraint. He freely shares his misguided opinions. He's always mouthing off. All he cares about is discovering his own mind, letting everybody know what he's thinking. Stubbornly insists on his own way, deceives the authorities in his life, openly identifies by his fashions with the godless, attitudinal, and cultural trendsetters and entertainers of the day. He avoids attempt to hold him responsible. He knows what he wants, and he is sneaky about it. In the process of all of this, his conscience is deadened. And he becomes increasingly less sensitive to the scriptures and to the Word of God and to the Spirit of God. But Satan doesn't leave us there either. The fool graduates into the scorner. And this is the person who is not just content to do some evil things himself and be deceptive and resist authority, but he gets a lot of people to go along with him. And it takes, Proverbs says, it takes strong judgments to deal with the scorner. This is the person who is really openly wicked. And we've got a society of scorners today. We've had a lot in politics. We've had some in the White House. These are people who are wicked and defend it, and their lives are wasted for anything eternal. That's the scorner. Folks, this is why the scriptures warn us so much against worldliness. As we saw, Paul said, do not be conformed to this world. The Apostle John says, love not the world. James says, keep yourself unspotted from the world. The world lies in the power of the evil one. The world is run by the prince of the power of the air. Christ died to deliver us from this present evil world. And we have a lot of believers who are wholeheartedly going after the world. And the world is becoming like that. And many churches are very worldly. They're using the world's methods and the world's music. And there's nothing different between them and the world. They're being conformed to this world. This is not godliness. This is worldliness. Well, what is the solution? The solution is to cultivate arete. To come to this decision that and this ongoing commitment that I'm going to live to become like Jesus Christ no matter what. I don't care what the world is like. I'm going to be like Jesus Christ. This is the start of Christian maturity. And Jesus said it would cost us everything. He said you will lose your life to get this. We could say that cultivating arete, that pursuit of the excellence of Christ's likeness, is capturing our heart for Christ. It is this mindset that turns us away from the allurements of the world and our own sinful heart to cultivate the essential virtues that Peter is going to lay out for us. And so I have some questions for us to consider. I want to ask you, whom are you desiring to become like? Somebody in this world or Jesus Christ? Whom do you imitate? What virtues of that person do you try to emulate? In what ways do you show forth the excellencies of that person to the people around you? Are the models you seek to emulate the celebrities of the day, either entertainment or athletic personalities? And what is it about them that is attractive to you? Their wealth? Their fame? Their skill at acting or singing or sports? How does your lifestyle reflect that they have captured your heart? Is it by wearing clothes they would wear, using language they would use, putting their posters up in your bedroom, watching the movies or games in which they are playing, going to their concerts or buying the songs in which they perform, taking up hobbies they enjoy or keeping up with their personal websites and blogs? Who are you imitating? Who are you trying to be like? Folks, Christ must have our heart if he's going to transform our character. And you renew this every day. When I get up in the morning, the first conscious thought I try to make, I try to sit up on the side of the bed, collect my thoughts, and I try to make this commitment every day. Father, because of what he did in my place on the cross, and what he has said to me in his word, and what he will require of me at the judgment, I must live all of life today under the lordship of Jesus Christ. And I need your help to do that. All I'm trying to do is cultivate arete. Some days are better than others. But folks, you'll get nowhere unless you come to this decision. This is what my life must be all about. And then you must renew that every day and sometimes several times a day. Add to your faith virtue, arete, the excellence of becoming like Christ.